A One-Woman Crime Wave, 1931. A Great Depression had swept over the nation, and we couldn't seem to throw it off. It was still hoovering over us, as people said. It hadn't bottomed out yet, but it was heading that way. You could see hard times from the window of the Wabash Bluebird. The freight trains on the siding were loaded down with men trying to get from one part of the country to another, looking for work and something to eat. Mary Alice and I watched them as they stood in the open doors of the freight cars. They were walking along the right of way, too, with nothing in their hands. Then when we got off the train at Grandma's, a new sign on the platform read, "Drifters, keep moving. This means you. Signed, O.B. Dickerson, Sheriff." But at Grandma's house it seemed to be business as usual. Mary Alice was still skittish about the old snaggle-toothed tomcat in the Cobb house. Grandma said if he worried her that much, she ought to use the chamber pot in place of the privy. Chamber pots were under all the beds, and they were handy at night. But Mary Alice wouldn't use hers during the day. She didn't want to climb the stairs just for that, and she didn't want to have to empty it any more than necessary. Being nine, Mary Alice decided to take charge. She carried a broom to the privy to swat the cat if it gave her any trouble. She was soon back that first afternoon, dragging the broom. Her eyes were watering, and she was holding her nose.
"Something died in the Cobb house," she said.
"Nah," Grandma said. "It's cheese."
"I don't want any," Mary Alice said.
"It's not for you," Grandma said.
Now that they mentioned it, I could smell something pretty powerful wafting into the kitchen, and I could see the old tomcat from here stretched out in the yard. He was breathing hard and nowhere near the Cobb house. The cheese smelled bad enough to gas a cat, but it was no use asking what it was for. We were bound to find out. Grandma's house was the last one in town. Next to the row of glads was a woven wire fence, and on the other side of that, a cornfield. On the first nights, I'd always lie up in bed, listening to the husky whisper of the dry August corn in the fields. Then on the second night, I wouldn't hear anything. But this year came the sound of shuffling boots and sometimes a voice. The Wabash tracks that cut the town in two ran along the other side of the road. The sheriff's deputies were out, carrying shotguns, moving the drifters along, so they didn't hang around town to beg for food. From my window I watched the swaying lanterns, and ahead of them the slumping figures of the drifters, heading for the next town. It was kind of spooky and sad. But it was a short night. At 5 the next morning, Grandma was at the foot of the stairs banging a spoon against a pan. When we got down to the kitchen, we found her in a pair of men's overalls stuffed into gumboots. She couldn't go outdoors in overalls, so she'd pulled a wash dress on over them, and her apron over that. Crowning it all was her gardening hat. She'd anchored it with a veil to keep the mosquitoes away and tied it under her chins. She looked like a moving mountain. Mary Alice couldn't believe the overalls.
"Keeps off the chiggers," Grandma explained. "We're going fishing."
I looked around for the rods and reels, at least some bamboo poles, but didn't see anything.
"It's just one thing after another in town," Grandma declared. "We wasn't over Decoration Day before it was the 4th of July. Then come the old settlers' picnic. You can't hardly get down the street for the crowds, and the dust never settles. I need me a day off and some peace and quiet."
Fresh from the Chicago Loop, Mary Alice and I traded glances. We didn't linger over breakfast because of the smell. The cheese was on the back porch now, in a gunny sack. It began to dawn on me that it was the kind of cheese catfish consider a delicacy. Grandma was ready to go, and when she was ready, you'd better be.
"Let's get on the road," she said. taking a last look around the kitchen.
Douse the fire and hide the axe and skillet.
We blinked.
Just a saying, Grandma said. A country saying. I was a country girl, you know.
She carried the gunny sack of cheese herself, tied to the end of a tree limb hitched up on her shoulder. I was in charge of the picnic hamper, and it took all I had to lift it. I looked inside. Half the hamper was home-canned fruit, tomatoes, and pickled peaches. The other half was vegetables from her garden, snap beans, four turnips, a cabbage. The only thing that looked like a picnic was a loaf of unsliced home-baked bread. But I didn't ask. Grandma saved herself a lot of bother by not being the kind of person you question. We trooped out into the morning behind her. As soon as we left her yard, we were in the country, but I had the feeling it could be a long trip. The hamper weighed a ton, and I had no luck in getting Mary Alice to carry the other handle. We were well covered against chiggers, and the day was already too hot. Mary Alice preferred skirts, but she had on her play suit with the long pants. Being 11, I was way too old for shorts anyway, so I had on my jeans. We marched behind Grandma, and it wasn't too bad until the sun came up over the tassels on the corn. We ate the dust of the road for a mile or so. Of course, being a city boy, I didn't know what a mile was, but it felt like a mile. At a stand of timber, we veered across a pasture. "Watch your step," Grandma said. "Cow pies aplenty." We were making for Salt Creek, and pretty soon the trees along the creek began to show on the horizon. But they were like a mirage that keeps its distance. Finally, we came to a barbed wire fence with a sign on it. "No trespassing whatsoever. No fishing. Nothing. Private property of Piatt County Rod and Gun Club. Signed, O.B. Dickerson. Sheriff."
"Lift that wire so I can skin under," Grandma said.
The lowest wire was pretty close to the ground, but Grandma was already flat on her back in the weeds. She'd pushed the cheese through. Now she began to work her shoulders to inch herself under. I pulled up on the wire to the best of my ability, but there wasn't much slack to it. The barbs snagged her hat, though they cleared her nose. But now here came her bosom. Mary Alice stood by, sucking in her own small chest, hoping to help. The wire cut my hand, and I was stabbed 3 times by the barbs. But like a miracle, Grandma shimmied under. Mary Alice followed with plenty of room, though she didn't like to get burrs in her hair. Being a boy, I climbed the wires and pivoted over on a fence post, on the heel of my wounded hand. I dragged the hamper through, and now we were in forbidden territory. It all looked overgrown and deserted to me. But Grandma, speaking low, said,
"Hush up from here on, and keep just behind me."
We were in trees and tall grass. As we sloped to the creek bottoms, the ground grew soggy underfoot. Dragonflies skated over the scum on the stagnant backwater. Grandma made her way along the willows, weeping into the water. When she pulled back a tangle of vines, we saw an old, worn-out, snub-nosed rowboat. It was pulled up and tied to a tree, and the oars were shipped in the wet bottom, beside a long pole with a steel hook at the end.
"Work that rope loose," Grandma whispered to me.
She pointed for Mary Alice to climb aboard, and she followed, reaching back to me for the hamper. The knot was easy, but pushing the boat out with Grandma in it wasn't. By the time the boat was afloat, I was up to my shoe tops in muddy water. I never thought for a minute that this was Grandma's boat, but she was one expert rower. She had the oars in the locks, and they pulled the water with hardly a ripple. She turned us and rowed along the bank, under the low-hanging limbs. We were on our way somewhere, quiet as the morning.
I was in the back of the boat, lolling, my mind drifting. Then I got the scare of my life. A low limb writhed and looped. I caught a quick glimpse of sliding scales and an evil eye, maybe a fang. Then an enormous snake dropped into the boat. It just missed Grandma's lap and fell hissing between her and me. The last thing I saw was this thing, thick as a tire, snapping into a coil. When I came to, we were tied up to a sapling, and Grandma was crouched over me. She was applying a rag wet with creek water to my forehead. Mary Alice was behind her, looking round-eyed at me. "You fainted, Joey," she accused. "Boys don't faint. I passed out, and it was probably mostly the heat. Sunstroke, maybe." Then I remembered the snake and grabbed up my knees. "Never mind," Grandma said. "It's gone. It was harmless. Good-sized, but harmless. There's cotton mouths around, though, so I'd keep my hands in the boat if I was you."
"It was swell," Mary Alice said. "It was keen. You should have seen how Grandma grabbed it up by its tail and snapped it just once and broke its neck."
"It was all neck, if you ask me."
"Then she hauled off and flung it way out in the water," Mary Alice went on relentlessly. "Grandma's something with snakes. You should have seen..."
"Okay, okay," I muttered. Grandma stifled a rare smile. I suspected she had no high opinion of the bravery of the male sex, and I hadn't done anything to change her mind. Why wasn't it Mary Alice who'd done the fainting? It bothered me off and on for years. We were underway again, me keeping a sharp eye on low-hanging limbs. I was recovering from everything but embarrassment, and Grandma was rowing out from the bank. Now she was putting up the oars and standing in the boat. It rocked dangerously, though she planted her big boots as wide as the sides allowed. She reached down for the long rod with the hook at the end. Glancing briefly into the brown water, she plunged the rod into the creek. It hit something, and she began to pull the rod back up, hand over hand. She was weaving to keep her balance in the tipping boat. I wanted to hang on to the sides, but pictured a cottonmouth rearing up and sinking fangs in my hand. Something broke the surface of the creek, something on a chain Grandma had hooked. It was bigger than the picnic hamper and looked like an orange crate, streaming water. And inside, whipping tails and general writhing. I thought of cottonmouths and ducked, but they were catfish, mad as hornets, who'd been drawn by Grandma's terrible cheese. She heaved in the crate and unlatched the top. In the bottom of the boat was a wire and net contraption that expanded as she filled it with wiggling fish. A catfish is the ugliest thing with gills, and even Mary Alice drew back her feet. Grandma kept at it, bent double in the boat. She was as busy as a bird dog, one of her own favorite sayings. When all the catfish were in the net, flopping their last in the bottom of the boat, she took the new cheese out of the gunny sack and stuck it in the crate.
"Grandma, how did you remember where it was?"
I said, amazed.
"You couldn't see it, but you snagged it with the hook right off."
"Remembered where I'd sunk it," she said briefly.
Now she was lowering the empty crate, baited with cheese, back in the water. Except it wasn't a crate. It was a fish trap. Where we went in Wisconsin to fish, using a fish trap carried a $5 fine.
"Grandma,"
I said,
"is trapping fish legal in this state?" "If it was,"
she said,
"we wouldn't have to be so quiet."
"What's the fine?"
"Nothing, if you don't get caught,"
she said.
"Anyhow, it's not my boat."
Which was an example of the way Grandma reasoned.
"Them critters love that cheese,"
she said fondly, as the trap sank from view. She bent over the side to try to wash the smell off her hands, nearly swamping the boat. Soon we were gliding gently downstream, Grandma rowing easy. The catfish were at her feet, flopping less now. My brain buzzed. Dad was a dedicated fisherman. He tied his own flies. He was a member of the conservation club. What if he knew his own mother ran illegal fish traps? Brewing home beer was one thing because the prohibition law only profited the bootleggers. But we're talking about good sportsmanship here. I noticed Mary Alice's eyes on me. She was watching me around Grandma's rowing arm, and she was reading my mind. It was then we decided never to tell Dad. You could say one thing for Grandma's method. You got all your fishing done at once. It wasn't later than 8 o'clock, and maybe we'd gotten away with it. It seemed to me we ought to have brought some poles along, and a can of worms, considering our catch. But I thought maybe things would settle down now, and we could have the quiet day in the country Grandma wanted. Then we heard singing. I almost jumped out of the boat. It had felt as if we three were alone in the world. Now this singing warbled up from around a bend in the creek, like a bad barbershop quartet with extra voices chiming in. Camp Town ladies, sing this song, doo-da, doo-da. Grandma nudged the boat into the bank just where the creek began to bend. Through the undergrowth, we saw a ramshackle building on the far bank. Above the porch was a sign, a plank with words burned in, Rod and Gun Club. A row of empty whiskey bottles stood on the porch rail, and from behind them came the singing. Bet my money on the bobtail nag, somebody bet on the bay. The porch sagged with singers, grown men in their underwear, still partying from last night, old guys in real droopy underwear. It was a grisly sight, and Mary Alice's eyes bugged. I wasn't sure she ought to be seeing this. They were waving bottles and trying to dance. I didn't know what they'd do next. Grandma was fascinated. As we watched, a skinny old guy with a deputy's badge pinned to his long john stepped forth and was real sick over the rail into the water.
Earl T. Askew, Grandma muttered, president of the Chamber of Commerce.
But now a fat old geezer in the droopiest drawers and nothing else pulled himself up on the porch rail. Bottles toppled into the water as he stood barefoot on the rail, teetering back, then forward, while the others behind him roared, "Whoa! Whoa!"
"Shut up a minute," he roared back at them, "and I'll sing you a good song."
He took a slug out of the bottle in his fist and began.
The night that Patty Murphy died, I never shall forget. The whole darn town got stinking drunk, and some ain't sober yet. The only thing they done that night that filled my heart with fear, they took the ice right off the corpse and put it in the beer.
Then he fell back into the arms of the cheering crowd.
"Ain't that disgusting?" Grandma said. "He couldn't carry a tune in a bucket." "Who is he?" I whispered. "O.B. Dickerson, the sheriff," she said. "And them drunk skunks with him is the entire business community of the town."
Mary Alice gasped. The drawers on some of the business community were riding mighty low.
"They're not acting right," she said, very prim. "Men in a bunch never do," Grandma said.
They were tight enough to fight, too, and we were on their private property. Not only that, we were in a boat full of trapped fish almost under the bloodshot eye of the sheriff. I thought it was time to head upstream as fast as Grandma could row. But no! She jammed an oar into the bank to push us off. Then she began rowing around the bend.
My heart stopped. The full chorus was singing again louder as we got nearer. Sweet Adeline, old pal of mine. The Rod and Gun Club came into view, and so did we. Mary Alice was perched in the bow. Grandma was rowing steady, and I was in the stern, wondering if the fish showed. It took the drunks on the porch a moment to focus on us. We were sailing right past them now, smooth as silk, big as life. You're the flower of my heart, sweet Ad. They saw us, and Grandma saw them, as if for the first time. She seemed to lose control of the oars, and her mouth fell open in shock. Mary Alice was already shocked and didn't have to pretend. I didn't know where to look. Some of the business community were so far gone they just stared back, unbelieving. They thought they owned this stretch of the creek. A few, seeing that Grandma and Mary Alice were of the opposite sex, scrambled to hide themselves behind the others. But you never saw anybody looking as scandalized as Grandma was at these old birds in their union suits, and less. She was speechless as her gaze passed over them all, recognizing everybody. It was a silent scene until Sheriff O.B. Dickerson found his voice.
"Stop in the name of the law," he bellowed. "That's my boat."
Before the Rod and Gun Club was out of sight, Grandma had regained control of the oars. She rowed on as if none of this had ever happened. The sun was beating down, so she didn't push herself. After all, the sheriff couldn't chase us downstream. We were in his boat. Around another bend and a flock of turtles sunning on stumps, Grandma pulled for the remains of an old dock. We tied up there, and now we were out of the boat, climbing a bluff. Grandma led, dragging the net of catfish. I was in the rear, doing my best with the picnic hamper. Mary Alice was between us, watching where she walked. She was scarier of snakes than she let on, if you ask me. An old house without a speck of paint on it stood tall on the bluff. Its outbuildings had caved in, and the privy stood at an angle. There were still prairie chickens around in those days, and they were pecking dirt. Otherwise, the place looked lifeless. Rags hung at the windows. The porch overlooking the creek had fallen off. Grandma tramped around to the far side of the house. She dropped her fish on the ground and waved us inside. Even in full daylight, the place looked haunted. I didn't want to go in, but Mary Alice was marching through the door already, so I had to.
"Is anybody inside?"
I whispered to Grandma as I lugged the hamper past her.
"Nobody but Aunt Puss Chapman," she said, like anybody would know that.
It had been a fine house once. A wide black walnut staircase rose to a landing window with most of its stained glass still in. But it was creepy in here, dim and dusty. Smelled funny, too. We went into a room piled up with furniture. Then one of the chairs spoke.
"Where you been, girl?"
Mary Alice flinched, but the old woman lost in the chair was staring straight at Grandma and calling her girl. She was by many years the oldest person we'd ever seen up till then, bald as an egg, but she needed a shave and not a tooth in her head.
"Who's them children with you?"
she demanded of Grandma.
"Just kids I found along the creek bank," Grandma said to our surprise. "They was fishing."
"I don't know as I want them in the house,"
Aunt Puss Chapman sent us a mean look.
"Do they steal?"
"Nothing you've got," Grandma said under her breath.
"Talk up, girl,"
Aunt Puss said.
"You mumble. I've spoken to you about that before."
She pulled her shawl closer, though it was the hottest day of the year.
"I'm hungry. hungry. You hightailed it out of here after breakfast, and I ain't seen hide nor hoof mark of you since.
She ain't seen me for a week, Grandma mumbled to us, but she forgets.
Then she called out to Aunt Puss.
Catfish and fried potatoes and onions, vinegar slaw and a pickled peach apiece, and more of the same for your supper.
I suppose it beats starving,
Aunt Puss snapped.
But hop to it, girl, stir your stumps.
I thought I might faint again. Nobody could talk to Grandma like that and live. She led us back to an old-time kitchen. It was in bad shape, but well-stocked. Big sacks of potatoes and onions, cornmeal, things in cans. And we'd brought a full hamper to add to Aunt Puss's larder. I had to fire up the stove with a bunch of kindling while Grandma and Mary Alice went to work on the potatoes and onions. Mary Alice was in as big a daze as I was.
Grandma, is that nasty old lady your aunt?
I stopped to listen. If she was, that made her our great-great-aunt.
Nah, I was hired girl to her before I was married, Grandma said. Lived in this house and fetched and carried for her and slept in the attic.
You had a room in the attic?
Nah, I just slept up there. Had a bed tick with straw in it and changed it every spring. I haven't always lived in the luxury you see me in now.
What did she pay you, Grandma?
Pay? She didn't pay me a plug nickel, but she fed me.
I thought about that. And now you feed her, I said. But Grandma didn't reply. We cleaned the fish on a plank table outdoors. I didn't care much for it. It made me kind of sick to hear Grandma rip the skin off the catfish. She had her own quick way of doing that, but every time it sounded like the fish screamed. She put me in charge of chopping off their heads, but I didn't like chopping off the head of anything looking back at me. And catfish have mustaches for some reason, which is just plain weird. Finally, Mary Alice took the rusty hatchet out of my hand, and whoomp! She'd bring down the blade and that fish head would go flying. Mary Alice was good at it, so I let her do it. Grandma gutted. It was afternoon before we sat down at the dining room table under a cobwebby gasolier. Aunt Puss was already at her place, so she was spryer than she looked. Grandma settled at the foot of the table. Without her hat, her white hair hung in damp tendrils. We'd been working like a whole pack of bird dogs. Watching Aunt Puss gum catfish was not a pretty sight.
"These fish taste muddy," she observed. "You uns catch 'em?"
"Yes," I said.
"No,"
Mary Alice said.
"What did you use for bait?"
Aunt Puss said, looking at both of us. "Cheese," I said.
"Worms,"
Mary Alice said, more wisely. Since we couldn't get together on our story, Aunt Puss changed the subject.
"You children still in school?"
We nodded.
"Do they whoop you?"
"Do they what?" Mary Alice said.
"Do they paddle your behind when you need it?"
Aunt Puss looked interested.
"If they did, I'd quit school," said Mary Alice, who'd just completed third grade.
"They whooped that girl raw,"
Aunt Puss pointed her fork down the table at Grandma. I had a sudden thought. Aunt Puss thought Grandma and Mary Alice and I were all about the same age. She hadn't noticed the years passing. That's why Grandma didn't say we were her grandkids. It would just have mixed up Aunt Puss.
"That's when she come to work for me. They'd throwed her out of school."
Aunt Puss peered down the table.
"Tell 'em why."
We looked at Grandma, naturally interested to know why she'd been thrown out of school. Grandma waved us away.
"I forget," she said. "I don't,"
Aunt Puss waved a fork.
It was because you wadded up your underdraws to stop up the flue on the stove and smoke out the schoolhouse. That was the end of your education.
Working for you was an education, Grandma muttered, though only Mary Alice and I heard. It took us another hour to clean up the kitchen the way Grandma wanted to leave it. When it was time for us to go, Aunt Puss was back in her chair in the parlor.
"Where do you think you're off to now?"
she called out as we trooped through the front hall. "Down to the sty to slop the hogs," Grandma called back.
"Well, don't dawdle. You dawdle, and I've spoken to you about that before. Get on out of here,"
Aunt Puss hollered.
"Let the door hit you where the dog bit you."
"Outdoors," I said. "Does she have hogs?"
"She used to," Grandma said. "She was right well off at one time. She's poor now, but she don't know it."
"How could she? She still had her hired girl and plenty to eat." "You take her food every week, don't you, Grandma?"
"Generally a good big roast chicken. She can gum that for days."
Grandma turned down the lane. "It keeps her out of the poor farm, and it gives me a quiet day in the country. That's a fair swap." Then her jaw clenched in its way.
"But it's just private business between her and me, and I don't tell my private business."
We walked country roads all the way home. Grandma set a brisk pace, and I struggled along behind with a hamper heavy with cleaned catfish. Mary Alice went in the middle, watching where she walked. By the time we got home, the trees in Grandma's yard were throwing long shadows, and it was evening in her kitchen. Mary Alice and I were both staggering. I was ready to go straight up to bed. But Grandma said,
"Skin down to the cellar and bring up 15 or 20 bottles of my beer. Just carry 2 at a time. I don't want any broke."
I whimpered, but she was turning on Mary Alice.
"And you and me's gonna fry up a couple pecks of potatoes to go with the fish. There won't be nothing to it. I peeled the potatoes this morning before you two was up."
We stared. The catfish fried in long pans with the potatoes and onions at the other end, popping in the grease. The kitchen was blue with smoke, and night was at the windows before we finished up.
"Now get down every platter I own," she told me.
Then she sent me for the card table I'd used for my jigsaw puzzle of Charles A. Lindbergh. Following her lead, we carried everything out into the night, making many trips. We lugged it all across the road and up to the Wabash Railroad right of way, and planted the card table in the gravel. Finally, the platters of fish and potatoes overlapped on the table, and the opened beer bottle stood in a row beside the tracks. As the drifters came along, being hounded out of town, Grandma gave them a good feed and a beer to wet their whistles. Mary Alice helped, in an apron of Grandma's that dragged the ground. They were hollow-eyed men who couldn't believe their luck. 2 or 3 of them, then 5 or 6, then a bunch standing around the table eating with both hands, sharing out the beer. They didn't say much. They didn't thank her. She wasn't looking for thanks. She'd taken off her overalls and put the same wash dress back on, but she'd tied a fresh apron over it. Her hair was a mess, fanning out from the bun at the back, white in the moonlight. She watched them feed, working her mouth. Then we saw the swinging lanterns, the sheriff and his deputies coming along behind to keep the drifters moving. Up trooped O.B. Dickerson, dressed now, with his badge on and his belt full of bullets riding low under his belly. His deputies loomed behind him, but they weren't singing Sweet Adeline.
"Okay, okay, break it up," he said, elbowing through the drifters. Then he came to Grandma. "Dag nabbit, Mrs. Dowdle, you're everywhere I turn. You're all over me like white on rice. Now what do you think you're doing?
I'm giving these boys the first eats they've had today.
Or yesterday, a drifter said.
Mrs. Dowdle, let me explain something to you, the sheriff bawled. We don't want to feed these loafers. We want them out of town.
They're out of town. Grandma pointed her spatula at the sheriff's feet. The town stops there. We're in the county.
Yes, and I'm the sheriff of the county, O.B. Dickerson bellowed. You're in my jurisdiction.
Do tell, Grandma said. Run me in.
The minute she said that, all the drifters looked up. That was when Sheriff Dickerson's deputies saw they were outnumbered.
Mrs. Dowdle, the sheriff boomed, I wouldn't know what to charge you with first. You're a one-woman crime wave. Where'd you get them fish, for instance?
He said, wisely overlooking the home brews in the drifter's hands.
Out of a trap in Salt Creek, Grandma remarked. Same as you get yours.
O.B. Dickerson's eyes bulged.
You accusing me, the sheriff of Piatt County, of running fish traps?
He poked his own chest with a pudgy finger.
Not this morning, Grandma replied. You was too drunk.
The drifters chuckled.
And talking about this morning, the sheriff said, his face shading purple even in the darkness. You stole my boat. That's what we call larceny, Mrs. Dowdle. You could go up for that.
Oh, well, the boat.
Grandma made a little gesture with the spatula.
You'll find it tied up at Aunt Puss Chapman's dock. As a rule, I take it back where you tie it up. But, of course, I couldn't do that this morning. How could I row these grandkids of mine back past the Rod and Gun Club? They'd already seen what no child should. The sheriff and his deputies, blind, drunk, and naked as jaybirds, dancing jigs on the porch, and I don't know what all. It's like to have marked this girl for life.
Grandma nudged Mary Alice, who stood there in the big apron looking drooped and damaged.
I'm thinking about taking her to the doctor so she can talk it out. I don't want her to develop one of them complexes you hear about.
Whoa, the deputies murmured behind Sheriff Dickerson. Earl T. Askew stepped up and said into his ear, O.B., let's just let sleeping dogs lay. I got my hands full with Mrs. Askew as it is. The sheriff simmered, but said,
Okay, Earl, if you say so.
The sheriff and his posse were in retreat now, but he had to cover himself.
Mrs. Dowdle, he said, pulling a long face, there's things I can overlook, but it seems to me you're running a soup kitchen without a license from the Board of Health. I have an idea there's a law against that on the books.
Go look it up, O.B., Grandma said. See if there's a law against feeding the hungry. But I have to tell you, you've talked so long, the evidence is all ate up.
And of course it was. The drifters had wolfed down the last morsel. With a small finger, Mary Alice pointed out the bare platters. Only a faint scent of fried catfish lingered on the night air. The empty beer bottles went without saying. The drifters were moving off down the track, and the deputies were heading back into town. O.B. Dickerson spit in the gravel, swung around, and followed them, his big boots grinding gravel. We stacked the platters and rounded up the beer bottles for Grandma's next batch. I collapsed the legs on the card table. There wasn't a lot of music in Grandma, but she was humming as we worked. And I thought I recognized the tune.
The night that Patty Murphy died, I never shall forget.
Then, after our quiet day in the country, we carried everything back across the road under a silver dollar moon. The Day of Judgment, 1932.
I don't think Grandma's a very good influence on us, Mary Alice said.
It had taken her a while to come to that conclusion, and I had to agree. It reconciled us some to our trips to visit her. Mary Alice was 10 now. I believe this was the first year she didn't bring her jump rope with her. And she no longer pitched a fit because she couldn't take her best friends, Beverly and Audrey, to meet Grandma.
They wouldn't understand, Mary Alice said.
We weren't so sure Mother and Dad would either. Since we still dragged our heels about going, they didn't notice we looked forward to the trip.
The gooseberries were ripe when we got there that August, and come to find out, Grandma was famous for her gooseberry pies. Mary Alice and I were stemming berries at the kitchen table that first morning. Grandma was supervising a pan of them on the stove. The gooseberries popped softly as they burst open in boiling water. Then somebody knocked on the front door. Grandma ran an arm across her forehead and started through the house. We'd have followed, but she said,
"Keep at it."
When she came back, Mrs. L.J. Weidenbach, the banker's wife, was right behind her. If she'd thought she was going to be asked to sit down, she had another think coming. Grandma returned to the stove, leaving Mrs. Weidenbach beached by the kitchen table, where she overlooked Mary Alice and me. She was big on top, though nowhere near as big as Grandma, but she had tiny feet, teetering in high-heeled shoes. The heat of the kitchen staggered her, but then people from Death Valley would have keeled over in Grandma's kitchen.
"Mrs. Dowdle, I am here on a mission," she said, "and I'll come right to the point."
"Do that," Grandma said.
"As you know, this is County Fair Week," Mrs. Weidenbach said, "the annual opportunity for our small community to make its mark."
Grandma said nothing.
"As you recall," Mrs. Weidenbach said, "my bread and butter pickles have taken the blue ribbon every year since the fair recommenced after the Great War."
If Grandma recalled this, she showed no sign.
"But my cucumbers this year haven't been up to snuff, not worth the brine for pickling. How were yours?"
"Didn't put any in," Grandma said.
"Ah, well, you were wise."
Mrs. Weidenbach's forehead began to look slick. It wasn't just the heat.
"Mrs. Dowdle, I'll come clean. I don't think I better enter my bread and butter pickles this year, and I'm going to tell you why. The depression is upon us. Times are hard."
"They was never easy for me," Grandma recalled.
"And quite unfairly," Mrs. Weidenbach said, "people blame the bankers."
"My stars," Grandma said. "The bank forecloses on people's farms and throws them off their land, and they don't even appreciate it?"
"Now, Mrs. Dowdle, don't be like that."
Mrs. Weidenbach reached down the front of her dress and plucked up a lace handkerchief. She dabbed all around her mouth.
"Mr. Weidenbach has asked me not to enter my bread-and-butter pickles into competition at the fair this year."
"Keep your head down till the depression blows over?"
"Something like that," Mrs. Weidenbach murmured. "So I naturally thought of you. After all, we've been neighbors these many years."
The Weidenbachs lived at the far end of town in the only brick house.
"I said to my husband, Mr. Weidenbach, somebody must carry home a blue ribbon to keep our town's name in front of the public. Otherwise, those county seat women will sweep the field. As you know, Mrs. Cowgill's decorative butter pats never do better than honorable mention."
If Grandma knew who won what at the county fair, she showed no sign.
"But there is nobody to touch you for baking with gooseberries. Even those of us who've never had a taste have heard. Word gets around."
"Try as a person will to keep it quiet," Grandma said.
"Gooseberries are tricky things," Mrs. Weidenbach went on. "Now you take Mrs. Watzmeyer over at Bement. She wouldn't take on a gooseberry, but she'll pull down a blue ribbon in the fruit pies and cobbler's division with her individual cherry tarts, if somebody doesn't put a stop to her.
Quiet followed, as we listened to Grandma's wooden spoon scraping the sides of the stew pan. At length she said,
I cook to eat, not to show off.
Mrs. Weidenbach sighed. Mrs. Dowdle, these are desperate times. Don't hide your light under a bushel. It is up to you to hold high the banner for our town.
Grandma putting herself out for the fame of the town? I thought Mrs. Weidenbach was on the wrong track. On the other hand, Grandma liked to win. Growing frantic, Mrs. Weidenbach let her gaze skim over Mary Alice and me.
And a day at the fair would be a nice outing for your grandkiddies.
Wouldn't cut any ice with them, Grandma said. They're from Chicago, so they've seen everything. Instantly, an expression of great boredom fell over Mary Alice's face. I thought she might yawn. She was playing along with Grandma. I'd been thinking a day at the fair would be a welcome change, that I just shrugged and went on stemming gooseberries. Grandma turned slightly from the stove.
Wouldn't have any way to get there if I wanted to go.
Mrs. Weidenbach brightened.
I will personally conduct you to the fair on prize day in my hopmobile.
She waved a hand in benediction over us.
And there'll be plenty of room for your grandkiddies.
Oh, well, Grandma said. If I have an extra pie and it's not raining that day.
Mrs. Dowdle, I knew you would stand and deliver.
Mrs. Weidenbach clasped her hands.
And remember, even the red ribbon for second prize will be better than nothing.
Grandma gazed past her, seeming to count the corpses on the flypaper strip. Mrs. Weidenbach was dismissed and soon left. We all listened to the powerful roar as she ground her hupmobile into gear. Grandma's sleeves were already turned back, or she'd be turning them back now. She pointed at me.
Scoot uptown and bring me a 25-pound sack of sugar. Tell them to stick it on my bill. After that, I want every gooseberry off them bushes out back.
She turned on Mary Alice.
And you're gonna learn a thing or two about pie crust.
There followed three of the busiest days of my young life. Wrestling 25 pounds of sugar back from Moore's store was nothing to picking all the gooseberry bushes clean. As Mrs. Weidenbach said, gooseberries are tricky things. Sour to the taste and spiky with stickers. Not unlike Grandma. My throbbing hands were covered with sticker wounds from getting all the gooseberries into the pail. With towels around their middles and their hair tucked up, Grandma and Mary Alice rolled out endless pastry on big breadboards. We baked a gooseberry pie every 4 hours for the next 3 days. I had about all I could do to feed corn cobs into the stove to keep the oven heat even. Gooseberries are so tart that more sugar than fruit goes into the pie. Some pies were still too sour, others gritty with too much sugar. We tried and tried again. Grandma grew careful about balancing her ingredients, holding the measuring cup up to the light. She was like a scientist seeking the cure for something. I had to go back uptown for more sugar and another big can of Crisco, and we had to sample them all in search for the perfect pie. Mary Alice says she's never since been able to look a gooseberry in the face. The day of judgment came. Mary Alice and I were in the parlor early, waiting. Grandma had told us to cover our heads against the fairground sun. I had on the Cubs cap I traveled in, and Mary Alice wore her straw from Easter. The house reeked of baking. Then Grandma sailed like a galleon into the front room, striking us dumb. For her, dressing up usually meant taking off her apron. But this morning she wore a ready-made dress covered with flowers. The collar was fine net, fixed with a big cameo brooch that rode high. On her feet were large, unfamiliar shoes, white, with a hint of a heel, and laces tied in big, perky bows. On her head was a hat with a big brim. The hatband on it happened to be a blue ribbon. She glared, daring us to pay her a compliment. But the cat had our tongues. Mary Alice stared up at her, transfixed. Was she seeing herself 50 years hence? The Hupmobile growled up outside, and the next thing you knew, we were in it. It wasn't as long as Al Capone's big Lincoln limousine, but it was the biggest car in this town. Mary Alice and I had the back seat to ourselves. The pie was in a box between my feet. Grandma took charge of a small hamper full of our lunch, since they charge you two prices for everything at a fair. She rode up front beside Mrs. Weidenbach, with one big elbow propped outside the open window. The town had emptied out because this was prize day at the fair, but when we went by the Coffee Pot Cafe, there were faces at the window, and a loafer or two paused on the sidewalk to see us pass. Grandma inclined her head slightly. Most people wouldn't take their bows till after they'd won a blue ribbon, but Grandma wasn't most people. The fairground was a pasture along a dusty road this side of the county seat. It was a collection of sheds and tents and a grandstand for the harness racing. But this was the big day for judging cattle, quilts, and cookery, so the grounds were packed, though it was a nickel to get in. Mrs. Weidenbach twinkled along in her high heels next to Grandma. She didn't dare show her pickles, but she wanted some reflected glory in case the gooseberry pie won.
"Let's run that pie over to the domestic sciences tent and get it registered," she said.
"I don't want it setting around," Grandma said. "The livestock draws flies."
The pie was no burden to Grandma because I was carrying it.
"Let's see something of the fair first," she said, managing to sound uninterested.
Along the midway, the Anti-Horse Thief Society had a stand selling burgoo and roasting ears. The 4-H Club was offering chances on a heifer. Alice Chalmers had a big tent showing their huskers and combines. Prohibition was about to be repealed, but the temperance people had another big tent offering ice water inside and a stage out front with a quartet performing. We stopped to hear them.
"You may drive your fast horse if you please. You may live in the very best style. Smoke the choicest cigars at your ease and may revel in pleasure a while. Play billiards from morning till night, or loaf in the barroom all day. But just see if my words are not right. You will find in the end it don't pay."
At the other end of the midway was a rickety Ferris wheel, a merry-go-round, and a caterpillar. Beyond it was a sight that drew me. In an open stubble field, a biplane stood. Beside it was the pilot, in a leather helmet with goggles and putties wrapped around his legs. And a sign, "Barnstorming Barney Buchanan, Air Ace, Trick Flying and Passenger Rides." My heart skipped a beat and sank. Another sign read, "Rides, 75 cents. I didn't have that kind of money on me. I didn't have any money on me. Still, my heart began to taxi. I'd never been in a plane, and my hero was Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh, who'd flown the Atlantic alone. The American Legion was sponsoring Barney Buchanan. A red-faced man in a Legionnaire's cap bawled through a megaphone.
"Tell you what I'm gonna do, folks. Any minute now, Mr. Buchanan is gonna show us his stuff by putting his machine through the same maneuvers he used in the Great War against the wily Hun. Then, if you think 6 bits is still too steep, Mr. Buchanan has agreed to a special prize day offer. To every Blue Ribbon winner, Mr. Buchanan will give a ride in his plane gratis. That's free of charge, ladies and gentlemen.
My heart left the ground, skimmed a hedgerow, and sailed into the wild blue yonder. The pie in my hands would win first prize, since nobody but Grandma would take a chance with gooseberries. But she'd let me have her plane ride because she was too old and too big.
"You reckon that thing will get off the ground?" she said doubtfully, building my hopes higher.
"It looks like a box kite," Mary Alice said. "A person would have to be nuts to go up in it."
The biplane's wings were canvas-covered and much patched. It was more rickety than the Ferris wheel. Still, it was a plane, and this looked like my one chance in life to go up in one. Now Mrs. Weidenbach was plucking at Grandma's arm, and it was time to enter the pie into competition. When we four went into the domestic sciences tent, Grandma remarked,
"I said there'd be flies."
Surrounded by crowds, the long tables were all laid out. Jams and preserves, vegetables in novelty shapes, cakes and breads. A half-sized cow, carved out of butter, reclined on a block of melting ice. It was as hot as Grandma's kitchen in the tent, so people fanned paper fans, compliments of Brochier's funeral home, each with the Brochier motto printed on it. When you come to the end, you'll find a friend. Mrs. Weidenbach averted her eyes as we passed pickled products. I took charge of unpacking the pie and getting it registered at Fruit Pies and Cobblers. Grandma started at the other end of the table, casting an eye over the competition. Everything looked good to me, and I was wishing I was a judge so I could have a taste. A little card with a number and a name stood beside each entry. When she got to her own pie, Grandma froze. Next to it was another lattice-topped gooseberry pie. There was no doubt about it. Only gooseberries are that shade of gray-green, and it was a very nice-looking pie. The edges of its pastry were as neatly crimped as Grandma's, maybe better. She bent to read the card and whipped around. I followed her look as it fell on one of the smallest people in the tent. It was a man, one of the few there. A little tiny man. He wore small bib overalls, a dress shirt, and a bow tie. 4 or 5 strands of hair were arranged across his little bald head.
"Rupert Pennypacker," Grandma breathed.
You seldom saw her caught off guard. Was he responsible for the other gooseberry pie?
"Who?" I said. "The best home baker in the state of Illinois," Grandma said. "Him and me come up together out in the country, so I know."
Mrs. Weidenbach quaked. Even Mary Alice looked concerned.
"I'm a goner," said Grandma.
A puttering sound deafened us. It was Barney Buchanan, the air ace, right over our heads. He was doing his aerial stunts, barrel rolls and vertical figure eights, or whatever he did. Everybody looked up, though we could only see Tent. It was just a moment, but somehow I was sure. In that split second when we'd all looked up, I thought Grandma had switched her pie's card with Rupert Pennypacker's. It was a desperate act, but as Mrs. Weidenbach had said, these were desperate times. It was the wrong thing for Grandma to do, but I might get a plane ride out of it. My head swam. Grandma nudged me away from the table and elbowed through a parting crowd. She was making for Mr. Pennypacker. I wondered if she'd reach down, grab him by his bib, and fling him out of the tent. With Grandma, you never knew.
"Rupert," she said.
Standing beside him was the scariest-looking old lady I'd ever seen, weirder than Aunt Puss Chapman. She was only a little taller than Mr. Pennypacker, and dressed all in black, including the veil on her hat. She had warts, and her chin met her hat brim. There was a lump in her cheek that looked like it might be a bunch of chaw.
"You remember Mama?"
Mr. Pennypacker said to Grandma. His voice was high, like it had never changed. My voice hadn't changed either, but I was 12, so I still had hope. His old mama hissed something in his ear and tried to pull him away with a claw on his arm. "Well, may the best man win," Grandma said, turning on her heel. By now the judges were at work. They carried little silver knives and miniature trowels for sampling the cobblers and pies. Tension mounted. Nervously, Mrs. Weidenbach said to Grandma,
"What a nice, moist consistency your pie filling has, Mrs. Dowdle. I'm sure it will be noted. How much water did you add to the mixture?"
"About a mouthful," Grandma replied. The judging went on forever, but nobody left the sweltering tent. We all watched the judges chewing. Finally, Mary Alice said she thought she might faint, so I took her outside. Up among the clouds, Barney Buchanan was still putting his old biplane through its paces. He dived to earth, then pulled up in time. He gave us three loops and a snap roll, and my heart was up there with him, scouting for Germans. A voice rose from inside the tent, followed by gusts of applause. They were announcing the winners. Honorable mention. Third prize. Second. First. I didn't want to go back in there. I hoped we'd win, but I wasn't sure we should. Not if Grandma had switched. The tent quivered with one final burst of applause. People began streaming out, flowing around us. Then out strolled Mr. Pennypacker and his mama, clutching him. You couldn't read anything in that face of hers, but Mr. Pennypacker was beaming. From the clasp on his overall bib hung a blue ribbon.
"Shoot," Mary Alice said, "after all that pie crust I rolled out."
In a way, I was relieved. But then I saw my one and only chance for a plane ride crash and burn. Mr. Pennypacker was already heading for the field where the biplane was coming in for a landing. At last, Mrs. Weidenbach and Grandma came out. A nod from Grandma sent me back to the Hupmobile for our hamper of lunch. We ate it at a table in the temperance tent, sliced chicken washed down with ice water. Grandma had her great stone face on, but Mrs. Weidenbach tried to make the best of things.
"Never mind, Mrs. Dowdle. As I have said, a red ribbon for second place is not to be sneezed at or scorned. You did right well."
But Grandma hadn't come to the fair for second prize. She didn't wear it, if she'd bothered to collect it at all.
"And you were up against stiff competition," Mrs. Weidenbach said. "I dare say Rupert Pennypacker has had nothing to do all his life but wait on his dreadful mother and bake."
Consoling Grandma was a thankless task. She ate her chicken sandwich with her usual appetite, observing the crowds. If I could read her mind at all, she was thinking she could do with a cold beer. The day seemed to have peaked and was going downhill now. As we left the temperance tent, the quartet was singing in close harmony. "Lips that touch wine will never touch mine." We were ready to head for the parking pasture, but Grandma turned us the other way, toward the midway and the biplane.
"What?"
said Mrs. Weidenbach, but fell silent. We were walking through the fair, and something inside my ribcage began to stir. There ahead, the biplane was on the ground. Afternoon sun played off the dull mahogany of its propeller. Something within me dared to dream. I wasn't swooping. I didn't even taxi. but I was walking lighter. Giving Blue Ribbon winners free rides hadn't stimulated much business. Barney Buchanan was lounging beside his plane. He was smoking another cigarette in a cupped hand, pilot style. Grandma strode past the ticket table out onto the field. She paused to look the plane over from prop to tail. Then she glanced briefly down at me. I didn't dare look up at her, but my hopes were rising. Then she marched forward. When Barney Buchanan saw Grandma bearing down on him, he tossed away his cigarette.
"I'm a Blue Ribbon winner," Grandma announced. "Here for my ride."
"What?"
Mrs. Weidenbach said. My brain went dead. "Well, ma'am," Barney Buchanan said uncertainly, noticing her size. "And what class did you compete in?"
"Fruit pies and cobblers."
She held up a crumpled blue ribbon clutched in her fist. She gave him a glimpse of it, then dropped the ribbon into her pocketbook. "Well, ma'am, it seems to me I've already given a ride to a man who won first in pies," he said. "A little fellow."
"Oh, that's Rupert Pennypacker," Grandma said. "You got that turned around in your mind. He won in sausage and head cheese. Don't I look more like a pie baker than him?"
Grandma reached up to pull the pin out of her hat. She handed the hat to Mary Alice.
"Here, hold this. It might blow off."
I saw the hatband was missing from her hat. The blue ribbon.